Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Summertime is upon us, a time that often means travel, vacation fun, and family reunions. But to many Louisianians, summertime means hunger, and our children are the most vulnerable. When school's in session, breakfast and lunch are provided 5 days a week. But without extra support in the summer, that equates to missing 40 meals a month. Luckily, here in New Orleans, some big-hearted hospitality industry folks are here to help. We begin with Amanda Toops of Toops Meadery. Amanda and her husband Isaac first rose to the hunger challenge during the pandemic when they handed out more than 200 meals a week to hospitality workers and their families in need. Over an 18-month period, the Toops crew delivered over 100,000 meals into the community. Those indomitable, big-hearted Toops are back at it again. This summer, addressing our local childhood hunger issue. She'll tell us all about it. And New Orleans newcomer Mark Bucher of the Steakhouse Medium Rare is also helping feed our community through his nonprofit, Feed the Fridge, a successful program first developed during the pandemic in Washington, D.C., where Medium Rare originated. Mark shares his story. Then, finally, we learn about Nourish Louisiana, a state-funded food purchase program that buys food from local farmers from socially disadvantaged backgrounds and feeds communities that need it most. Louisiana's got a summertime hunger problem, but help is on the way on this week's Louisiana Eats. In February, Governor Jeff Landry announced that he'd rejected federal funding that would provide additional food assistance to low-income children in Louisiana during the summer. The Summer EBT program, which was created during the pandemic and recently made permanent, would give families $40 a month per child during the summer when children lose access to school meals. At a time when hunger is surging across the state, Landry's decision drew criticism and outrage, including from Amanda Toops of the restaurant Toops Meadery in New Orleans.
Well, his two statements about it have been really upsetting to me. The first one was, families need to learn to be more self-sufficient. Oh, okay. And his second one didn't get as much press, but it should have. A reporter who interviewed me several weeks ago told me that she asked Governor Landry, why would you turn down the funds that would feed kids? And he said to her face, kids will figure out a way to eat.
After Landry's decision, Amanda and her husband Isaac Toops decided to step up to try to fill the gap, announcing that Toops Meadery would resume its family meal program to feed food insecure families and provide free meals every day during the summer. Amanda spoke with us in April. Amanda, it's been too long since we had you in the Louisiana Eats studio. Welcome back.
I feel right at home.
The last time I believe, perhaps we spoke, was during the pandemic when you and Isaac had been running something that started as staff meal and turned into something a lot more. Tell me about that time.
So when the pandemic hit, of course, like all restaurateurs, we were scared. We didn't know what to do. But there's something called family meal in restaurants where we all eat together between lunch and dinner services. You want a full belly while you're running around busy. And so when we had to lay off our line cooks and our servers, we were adamant we were going to keep our management on and as long as we could. And we told them every day, come back and we're going to eat family meal together, before we knew we had to be separate. So this was right at the beginning. And so we made our normal, 15 family meals every day. And then the line cooks came through and they said, look, hey, boss, my roommate got laid off, too. Can I bring a meal for him? So, of course, we made 30. And then it was 60. And then it was 90. And then it was all service industry at first. We were just feeding service industry. And then mothers started reaching out to me, and I'm a mother. And so then it was everybody. And then eventually it was about 500 people a day at one point. And then we got really lucky, and we were the first restaurant in New Orleans to be onboarded with World Central Kitchen. So Jose Andreas's World Central Kitchen stepped in, and they paid us to cook for homeless people and veterans, which allowed us to keep affording our family meal because they were paying us to cook for those people. So over the course of about 18 months between our World Central Kitchen initiative and family meal, we were able to put about 100,000 meals into the community. So when we shut down family meal, I thought, well, we did it, and this is over, and it's just not over. It's going to have to come back. I've now spoken with three different doctors from three different hospitals who've reached out to me personally, one yesterday, and said they see so much food insecurity in children during the year that they're terrified of what's going to happen this summer.
So, Amanda, what did you decide you're going to do about this?
Well, I got real mad. I just got really mad. And Isaac and I both, are very sensitive to food insecurity when that happens, because we saw it so deeply during the pandemic. And I'll tell you this, when the pandemic hit, it only took 5 days for people to start reaching out and say, I have nothing. 5 days. That's how food insecure New Orleans is. That's how food insecure America is, which is infuriating. Because I do believe we have a great country, and I do believe we have a great state, and I do believe we have a wonderful city. But to be that food insecure, frankly, it's unacceptable.
It's unacceptable. We should be ashamed.
We should be ashamed. I am ashamed. So Isaac and I sat down, and we were talking about it, and we said, well, maybe we can do something. We've done it before. We know how to do it. Maybe we can do something. So here comes family meal coming back. But it's different this time, right? Because the hands are still out. They're hungry, but they're small hands. They're kids. So it's going to have to be a little bit different.
You did the most amazing thing. We're having this conversation fresh on the heels of your Easter outreach. Tell us about how you organized it and what you learned.
Yeah, a lot. So the first thing I did once we decided that we needed to bring family meal back was, we have a pretty large social media following. So I put it on Reddit, on Facebook, Mutual Aid. I put it on Instagram. And I said, hey, are you going to be affected in the summertime? Are your children going to be affected by not having these additional funds? Are you food insecure? Tell me what you need. Tell me, is it hot meals? Is it cold meals? Is it groceries? Is it a mix of both? Tell me what you're going to need. How many of you are there out there? And of course, there's thousands, and I'm not going to get to hear from everybody. I'll get to hear from a lot. And so they started flooding in, and I said, look, this is personal too. Email me. You don't have to put your business out on the internet. So I wanted to privately reach out too. And so I set up surveys that I could text them, and so they could fill out, and I could ask questions, and they could fill them out. So I said, okay, Isaac, you know what we should do? Two things. Everyone deserves a nice Easter dinner. Everyone deserves it, right? These food insecure people deserve it. Let's do that. And then secondfold, I can get my hands on them physically and go, can you get here? How many meals a week do you need to cover the spread? What is it? Are the kids alone during the day? Are you going to need delivery? Those things. So what I did was I crowdsourced and fundraised, and we fed 1,500 New Orleanians Easter dinner. And during that time, I was able to talk to the moms and the grandmothers, because it's like 99% women, and to understand what these needs are going to be. And I'm still really assessing it, because when I start this initiative in the summer, we're going to try and go 7 days a week, and I need to be a sharpshooter. I got to be right on time and hitting right where it needs to go, because I'm still a filthy capitalist. I still got to run a business. I still got to be open for lunch. I still got to be open for dinner. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that hit. I'm going to close the restaurant for happy hour every day from 3 to 5. We will once again become a community center. People will be able to come through, get their food and the meals they need for the kids. Hopefully a sack of groceries too, and then we'll go back to capitalism and we'll open for dinner at 5 p.m. So.
And, you know, and I know you all are making sure that it's healthy, it's nutritious, it's all of those things.
But they're still kids, and they get, and they got to want to eat it. So
what how do you handle that?
Yeah. So what we're planning to do after speaking to some of the moms is try and do like a sandwich box with like maybe a sandwich, some chips, and some fruit, and then also a prepared meal that's cold that they can the kids can put in the microwave. So red beans and rice and sausage with some green beans and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I want to be able to hand them a sack with, like, apples and bananas and granola bars and packets of grits and packets of oatmeal, because I'm hearing a lot of moms tell me, listen, I don't have a car. I take the bus to work. My kids are home alone during the day, and I don't want them using the stove, which I completely understand.
Right.
So for those moms, I'm going to try and figure out deliveries for them at least two or three times a week where I can get them a bunch of meals. But the way I don't want any contact with the children, so I figured out this text app where I will summon the drivers. I've got a list already going for summer and go, hey, this is a Gentilly route. I've got three families. Drop off these 10 meals. When it's dropped, you text me. I'll message mom. And then mom can tell the kids to open up the door after the driver's gone, grab the food, and go inside. So it'll be no contact.
So when you were gathering this information, how many children did it end up that?
Of the 1,500 humans we fed, 688 of them were children. So that gives me an idea of how many kids are going to be in need this summer that are going to be looking towards us.
Amanda, you're one restaurant. You're just one little restaurant family. How are you identifying, working with charitable partners? Because that has to be a big piece of this.
Yeah. Second Harvest is helping. They're kicking us down some groceries. We're already kind of putting those shelf-stable stuff aside for the summer. Charitable donations have been the massive help because, to be honest with you, we are a restaurant. So I can't have people who've pre-cooked things come into the restaurant and me put those out because I don't know where they've been.
Right.
So we still have to follow health guidelines and all of those things. And especially since kids, I can't get any kids sick or anything like that. So, but a lot of people, as far as like partners, a lot of people reached out. I can deliver. I had a lady from the Teachers Federation go, hey, we're off this summer. We can deliver meals to kids. The first letter that came in the mail was a very nice older couple from Avondale. And they said, we don't get to leave the house much anymore, but we used to feed the kids in New Orleans, and sent me a check for $200.
Aww.
And me and my GM stood there and cried like babies. We were just like, the amount of support that came out for us to do this, to feed the kids. And then the Kiwanis asked us to come in and speak. And so I got up and spoke to the Kiwanis. I didn't even know what the Kiwanis did. They take care of kids. I didn't know that. They invite us over, and I thought, oh, this, let me tamp down the political part of this because I don't want to be offensive in any way. And they were dynamos. I mean, these people were dynamos. And at the end, this older white gentleman comes over to me and he goes, I'm a Republican. This is bull. We're going to get these kids fed. And then they wrote us a check and said, keep going and tell us what you're going to need for this summer because we're going to come through for you. And so I cried in front of a room full of people I'd never met. And then it was $5 donations via Venmo. And you know what that makes me think? That was something for that person.
Yeah.
They sent us $5. That was a lot for you. And for sure it was. And that means something, that people in this city want to make sure these kids get fed and want to help us keep going. Humanity, I have a big belief in it right now. I'm riding high off of that part of it.
Oh, Amanda, that's the nicest thing. And it's really important that, you know, you're getting all this love and that you've had such a positive response. But I think we would be remiss in assuming it's all been love letters and roses, because you kind of got a Dear John letter from someone who obviously doesn't have a heart.
Over the years, Isaac and I have never been afraid to stand up for a cause that we believed in, whether that's women's rights or children. The death threats have always come. They have. They'll call the restaurant and threaten to kill us. I mean, it happens. It does.
This has happened in the past?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, like, mean and hateful messages and letters. And, well, this one is a letter. And he didn't put his last name and he didn't put his return address, but he essentially compared the kids that were going to go hungry to feeding wild animals in the forest, that if we fed them, then they'd become dependent upon us, like the animals in the woods. And then he wrote me a handwritten note saying that he was glad Landry had turned down the food and that I need to learn better or something along those lines.
Wow.
But Isaac got really mad. I cried. I wasn't crying because of him. I just cried because there was just so much emotions going around. And listen, there's always been people out there whenever we've taken a stand for something that send us hateful messages. And my staff actually now laugh it off. At first, we'd get all disturbed, like maybe they'll show up. And Sean, who's my friend in front of the house, he's a bartender. He's been with us through the pandemic. He's a Afghanistan and Iraq war veteran. He's like, bring it. You can't bring me anything I haven't seen. Like, show up. Like, it's just, you know, my staff is so hardened by it now. And they know I'll walk in the restaurant and Sean laughs at me the most. He goes, what did you say online today? Because the calls have started coming and he starts laughing.
Oh, gosh.
I'm like, Listen, I'm just mad about the kids.
Well, I am so grateful to know you all and love you all like I do. And it's just the most incredible package that you get these big hearts and all this charitable giving and the best cracklins on the face of the earth, too.
At first, when we first opened, I mean, it was a wing and a prayer, me and Isaac, you know. Our first child's 13 and our restaurant's 12. That's not by accident. You know, It makes you get your stuff together pretty quick. And so we chugged along like everybody else, you know, trying to make it through. But when the pandemic hit, our business model changed. And it's changed since then forever because we don't think of ourselves as just a restaurant anymore. We try and be as big a part of the community as we possibly can. And so philanthropy is now part of the business model. And that's going to go forward.
It's just the most amazing effort. I look forward to hearing the recap.
Thanks.
In the fall.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you,
Thanks
Poppy,
so
as always.
Much for this.
I love you.
I love you too. That was Amanda Toops of Toops Meadery in New Orleans. Since our conversation, the Louisiana legislature changed direction and finally approved the money needed to access the $71 million federal funding. I reached out to Amanda to see how this might affect her plans. She pointed out, economically challenged students miss breakfast and lunch when school is not in session, which amounts to 40 meals a month. And with 22% of Orleans Parish children currently living under the national poverty level, the need is great and the Toops are still on the job. Donations may be made at Toops Meadery on Cash App and Venmo or in person at their restaurant in Mid-City. Coming up next, we meet Mark Bucher of the restaurant Medium Rare in New Orleans. His nonprofit program, Feed the Fridge, fills public refrigerators with fresh, nutritious meals daily. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce. Always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. From Rouse's Markets. Synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets tastes like home. And from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. Camellia's latest innovation makes life easy for today's smaller households. Beans for two. If a bag of beans is too big for your family, Camellia's New Orleans-style red beans for two and Cajun-style white beans for two has everything needed for dinner in today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. In New Orleans, restaurant owners are joining forces with an organization based out of Washington, D.C. to help stamp out hunger. Feed the Fridge places refrigerators in public spaces and partners with restaurants to fill them with fresh, nutritious meals daily. The nonprofit was founded during the pandemic by D.C.-based chef Mark Bucher with a mission to provide a variety of meals and nourish people with dignity. Mark, who in 2023 opened a Magazine Street location of his steakhouse, Medium Rare, is just getting the program off the ground here in New Orleans. Partners currently include Dickie Brennan & Company, the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group, Howlin' Wolf, Southern Hospitality Catering, and Chef Diva Foods. We spoke with Mark about his philanthropy and the restaurant business that brought him to New Orleans.
I fell in love with New Orleans. I came down here after Katrina.
What were you doing here?
I came down to help people move out of their homes, gather their belongings. And then a subsequent trip was we were actually bleaching the framing of the homes to get rid of the mold and also to clear brush and clear lots. And I actually, in one of those homes we did, I found a litter of kittens that was in the brush in the backyard. I took two of them back to D.C. with me, to my family. And, you know, those kittens just passed last year, full lives. So that whole experience of being down here, I fell in love with the fight this city had, the real fight and the real neighborhood. You know, we're not done. Watch the comeback kind of thing. No one ever gave up here. And the families I talked to that didn't leave, I was in St. Bernard's Parish, which we did most of our stuff. It was truly mind-blowing. I always said, I'm going to do a restaurant here one day and be part of the community here. So when we started looking for sites, everyone had sites down in the French Quarter. Everyone had sites, you know, where all – I said, no. I want to find neighborhood. I want to build community. I want to be able to be part of the fabric of the city. I want to earn the right to be part of the fabric of the city. So we found this great spot on Magazine Street, a great landlord, and here we are.
Let's unpack for people the New Orleans medium rare experience. It's not particularly big. How many seats do you have?
So altogether, we have about 100 seats
in
there now, and it's cozy. Medium rares are meant to be cozy, a little tight, a little louder than your normal restaurant. You're meant to connect with what we do.
So the menu, is there a written menu or is it the servers? Let's talk about how that goes.
There is a written menu, but it's not everything. So for example, our menu reads artisan bread, which has a whole story going back to a very famous French chef in this country. Our house salad with one dressing, one salad, our steak frites, and then a few desserts. And on the back are a few cocktails and a few beers and wine. We're about simplicity. We think you make too many decisions during a normal day. When you come for dinner, let us make the decisions. We just want you to say, I want my steak cooked medium rare, medium, however you like it. We'll take care of the rest. Sit back and enjoy. When it comes for desserts, pick one of four. And we got it.
And it's a one price thing.
It's a one price thing. Correct. Prefix.
Uh-huh.
Just like they do in Europe. We do have a vegan vegetarian option that we have every meal always available, which is a grilled portobello and a fire roasted red pepper sauce. We always have a vegan option. Our fries are gluten free. My wife is vegan, believe it or not. So we accommodate that. The menu does change for brunch on the weekends. We do uneat. We didn't always set out to do brunch. When we first opened, we didn't do brunch. We do a bottomless brunch, bottomless drinks, prefix brunch menu, French toast, steak and eggs, egg frites, steak frites, and we mix it up a little bit for brunch. And, you know, some people are like, you don't know what you're getting yourself into in New Orleans. They're professional drinkers down here. There's no question about it. People found brunch 30 seconds after the sign went up on the door.
So why is philanthropy such an important part of your business model?
Philanthropy is an important part of everything I do. It's just the way I was raised. My parents are philanthropic. I kind of watched them do for others as a child. My first restaurant opened in 2007. And in 2007, deep frying turkeys was kind of becoming a big thing. And of course, the TV news are showing the deep fryers in people's driveways, blowing up, burning down the houses, how dangerous it is, which it really is if it's not done right. I said, you know what, look, I've got a restaurant, I've got fryers, I've got a fire suppression system and hood and exhaust hoods. Bring them to me. I'll deep fry them for you for free. Don't hurt yourself. Don't burn your house down. We'll just do that. So that first Thanksgiving in 2007, we did maybe the only real social media out there at that time was Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I put it out on Twitter and we had about 25 people come by. It was me, one of my daughters, I have four daughters, and one of my employees. And we get done the day to go home and now do our Thanksgiving with my family. You know, my arms are burned. I'm tired of being on my feet, lifting 20-pound turkeys all day. And, you know, it's a lot of work. And we clean up. We get to my car, which is parked out front. And there's a piece of paper underneath the windshield wiper. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. I got a parking ticket on Thanksgiving. After doing all this and burning myself, I'm never doing this again. This is not worth it. What kind of – it was a thank you note from a mom who had a family that lived in a shelter. Actually, across the street, I had no idea there was a shelter across the street. And she said, you know, without you, I wouldn't be able to cook this free turkey that I got for Thanksgiving so my family can have Thanksgiving together. Oh, my gosh. Well, now I can never stop doing this. And then every year we do that, and it got us thinking, there's a lot of people that get free turkeys, and a lot of people get free meals, free ingredients donated to them on Thanksgiving. Those who are typically food insecure or living at or below the poverty, they don't have the ability to cook it. So someone's got to be able to cook it so they can have family Thanksgiving together. So every year we do this and continue to do it even now. During COVID in its worst, we did it at National Baseball Stadium, which is our major league ballpark, with thousands of people lined up for it. So we do that every year. We're going to do that here this year too, by the way. When it was announced that COVID was coming, but no one had it yet, it was March 6th. They said, if you're over the age of 70 or you're immune compromised, just stay inside and ride COVID out. I put a tweet out. If anyone knows of anyone that's in the situation, I'll deliver them free, medium rare, no questions asked. My father passed away at 86, didn't have an iPhone, didn't like doing things online. He would call restaurants and place-to-go orders. He would go out and buy his groceries. I now knew if he was stuck home, isolated, he would starve. And I knew he wasn't the only one. So we started mashing together people, volunteers, my staff. Tens of thousands of free dinners went out. Some people took advantage of it. It was okay. We did a lot of good. Family members are emailing us. Building managers are emailing us. Neighbors are emailing us. And we're taking care of those who need to be taken care of because we can. They then announced that school's virtual. No school lunches. They got to eat. There was a story on CBS Sunday Morning that weekend about a woman that runs a community fridge program in L.A. And I turned to my wife. We're in our kitchen. I said, what if we did that with meals? And that's how it happened. That's how Feed the Fridge started. So that next morning, I called D.C. Public Schools and the Maryland Public Schools. I said, what's your plan? How can I help? They don't have a plan. D.C. said, I'm stuck. I really don't have a plan. But we do know that kids that don't have internet at their homes are going to go to our parks and rec centers for virtual classes. Xfinity's giving the internet there. Google's giving out tablets. They're going to come in there and they're going to be separated but do their schoolwork. I said, well, if it's okay with you, I'm going to put a refrigerator there and I'm going to fill it with medium rare every day. I don't have any refrigerators. I don't know how we're going to do this. I called the Washington Nationals and said, no one's at your stadium. Can I have some of those refrigerators, say Bud, Bud Light, and Coca-Cola on them that line the concourse? I said, how many do you need? I said, give me six. They said, sure, come get them. We get them. We take all the decals off of it. We place them in parks and rec centers, and we start filling them every day with meals. And that became the beginning of Feed the Fridge, which then led me to thinking about that first note I got on my windshield, realizing that there are a lot of people that are food insecure that get a lot of ingredients that can't cook them, whether arthritis, arthritic hands, they don't have pots and pans, can't afford pots and pans, SNAP benefits don't allow you to buy pots and pans. They need meals to eat. Bringing young children into soup kitchens is scary, mm-hmm. especially if they're kind of living a life where they're going to school and the mom or dad or they're working, but they don't have enough. Mm-hmm. So come get a meal. And we started placing our refrigerators in Parks and Rec centers, Boys and Girls Clubs, churches, health centers, Latin American youth centers, public schools, and DC fire and rescue stations. And at the height, we had 29 refrigerators putting out 3,000 meals a day.
Wow.
And we continue that today. So as we come here, feed the fridge is part of our DNA. It's part of my DNA now. I've become a little bit of an activist in the hunger movement, in the food insecurity movement. I think there's lots that we can fix to solve it. I think we do our much as we can to solve it. So here's the premise. The premise of Feed the Fridge is Feed the Fridge raises money from individuals, foundations, and companies. That money comes in and it contracts with local restaurants to make meals that we buy. So it also shores up restaurants. Mm-hmm. And these restaurants get picked up by any one of our delivery partners. We work with DoorDash or Uber Eats. They pick it up and they bring it to a signed refrigerator and they load it up for the day. Mm-hmm. And then the restaurant gets paid every day. And it's a great way to build up and strengthen a restaurant community that's often a tough business. Mm-hmm. When 80% of restaurants fail in a certain number of years, the business model has a problem. This helps. It's a way to get great, nutritious food to those who need it. We have dietary guidelines. We have specific meals, no white bread, no sugar, nothing fried. And we get these meals out that are designed to satiate a human until the next meal or next day. For a kid, it's one meal. If you're over the age of 70, it's two meals. And that's what we do.
Well, Mark, welcome to New Orleans.
Love being here.
I can tell you're just going to be a great new Orleanian. So thanks so much for coming and thanks for talking with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me.
That was Mark Bucher of Medium Rare on Magazine Street in New Orleans and the nonprofit Feed the Fridge. Coming up next, we learn about the Nourish Louisiana program, which buys food from local farmers and makes it available for food banks across the state. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, the beloved secret ingredient of Louisiana kitchens for over 90 years, made with just oil, vinegar, and egg yolks. Now Blue Plate is dressing up seafood feasts with a new creamy cocktail sauce. Enhanced with bold horseradish and a secret blend of spices, you just dip, savor, and say, ah. And for a touch of Creole charm, Blue Plate's Creole tartar sauce, complete with pickles, aromatic herbs, and a touch of Creole mustard, all together in that classic mayo base. Blue Plate mayonnaise, it's the good stuff. And from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this spring. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom-and-pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape, just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter. Nourish Louisiana is a food purchase program that buys food from local farmers from socially disadvantaged backgrounds and feeds it to communities that need it most. The state-funded program is investing nearly $5 million in local producers, allowing 5 Louisiana food banks to offer fresh produce, meats, seafood, and rice. To learn more about Nourish Louisiana, we spoke with 2 of the program's partners, Second Harvest and Sprout NOLA.
I'm Natalie Jarrow, President and CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank.
I'm Margie Green, and I'm at Sprout NOLA. I'm the Executive Director.
Margie, for people who might not be familiar with Sprout NOLA, what is your primary work?
Yeah, our primary work is supporting farmers and gardeners, specifically in Southeast Louisiana, but a couple of our programs go throughout the state. We're really excited that we have a lot of partnerships with other farmer and food support agencies throughout the state through a coalition called Louisiana Small Scale Agriculture Coalition. But our work is working on land access, technical assistance, market development for farmers with a specific focus on farmers who are underserved by general programs, you know, USDA programs, federal programs, or just societally like have had a harder time getting access to resources and funds.
A couple of years ago for us at Second Harvest, we were dipping our toe in the water. We got a grant. Margie was one of the people we turned to first to kind of help advise us on how it is that we approach this work of working with local disadvantaged farmers to help them build assets. The federal government, as part of its Recovery Act money, did something very progressive, which is kind of unheard of. And they made this money available to every state to work with disadvantaged farmers and to use that food for people that are food insecure. We were thrilled at Second Harvest because for the first time you were connecting all ends of the food system, the people that were growing the food and the people that needed the food the most that didn't always have access to it. So Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry called us up and said, what do you think of this? We said, absolutely. They said, well, you write the plan. And then we turned to Margie and others to help us figure out the best way to spend over $4 million with these farmers, but also leave them with markets with better chances of building assets and being strong, vital organizations. Whole goal of this is that we want sustainability built into everything that we're doing and that these farmers are better off as a result of this program.
Yeah, I think that the coolest thing about this program is where it lives between food access, the incredible work that Second Harvest is doing, and food production, because like Natalie was saying, there's just this, like an imperative to help a community thrive on the whole. And so what we've seen is because of structural racism, specifically Black farmers in Louisiana have had this underinvestment. And what's so amazingly progressive about this program is the nuts and bolts part that this partnership that we have, the Louisiana Small Scale Agriculture Coalition and Second Harvest, are working together to do this allows for us to do technical assistance for farmers. It allows us to leverage private funding to help develop infrastructure. So that's washing and packing infrastructure and get that to communities, specifically Black growers that haven't had those same accesses to services. So you'll see that there's lots of shared infrastructure for cooling, for washing and packing in some more supported or white farming communities, and that's not something that we've seen that investment in. So by working together, we can actually do basically an intake of farmers.
And as I mentioned before, one of the things that we have to bring to the table is capacity. What does Second Harvest have? We have warehouses, trucks, freezers, coolers, kitchens. We've just built a second line in our kitchen in Harahan that we're putting at the disposal of local farmers. Hopefully they are doing some value-added processing, which again works towards their building assets and creating an income stream for them. And we're working with the mayor out in Lake Charles, and we're hoping to put up a micro-enterprise kitchen there and perhaps even some retail frontage where we can bring in farmers. They can produce their product right there. We can sell it to people who are driving down I-10. And as they leave Louisiana, here's your last stop to get some of this great Louisiana food and recipe. So that's I'm getting a little ahead of myself because that's in the dream phase, but we're having that discussion. We think we can make that happen. But for us at Second Harvest, it's a space we want to be in permanently. If there's something we can do to make it possible for farmers to thrive and the people that we serve to have enough nutritious food to eat, we feel like that's a really win-win situation.
Is there a through line here where Second Harvest is actually purchasing this food?
So we have $4.8 million of federal funds coming down, which we think will yield 2 million pounds of food. And you're exactly right. One of the things that we can do is bring logistical and capacity to the table. So we'll have someone on staff with the help of Margie and this group of the small scale agriculture group that can connect us with these farmers. So we're making sure we're reaching out to the right people. Then what we do is kind of make it happen, make the purchases, and then figure out how to get that food out into our food bank system so that it's having the best possible impact for people who are food insecure.
And it might sound like, I think that it sounds like sometimes that's so simple, right? We've got all this money and we're just going to make these purchases. And I would also like to demystify like the immense work of Second Harvest in sort of logistics and coordination and how that becomes a totally different ballgame when you're working with local food. And so that's another part of that partnership is like when you're used to receiving food, you know, in a certain way and then distributing it in a certain way, this program really turns that all on its head. What does it look like to receive 300 pounds of food instead of 2,000 pounds of food at a time? What does that actually look like? So yesterday, two of our farmers that we've been working with for a really long time, some really old friends of both my organization and several other organizations in our coalition, were able to be the inaugural purchase yesterday.
So exciting.
It's so cool. I think we're all like on the moon. They were able to get this really amazingly fair market price, which is a cool part of this program. It enables us to not have anyone haggling. You know, it's true equity in that pricing structure, especially because these are purchases from Black farmers or Indigenous farmers of color. And so when we cannot be needling people down on that price, it's so important because that's part of that building equity. And I'm just like, I want to kind of shout out that we had that giant green onion purchase yesterday. And it's like day one.
It was green onions.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And what do you do then with all those green onions?
Oh, there are 800,000 people throughout the state of Louisiana who are food insecure every single day. So for this particular program, that food is going out through our food bank networks. And you know, we're one of five Feeding America food banks in the state of Louisiana. So we're portioning this out to the food banks to get it into those communities where people are most at risk for hunger. But like I said, I mean, that's part of this program. But you know, it's not the total hope. The hope is that we're going to help these farmers build markets and sustainability. Maybe it's with schools, hospitals, whatever way we can think of. If we can bring some capacity to bear so that the volume can get to a place where farmers can afford crop insurance, you know, or buy the kind of equipment. Margie, I mean, one of the learnings that we had and one of the strange things about this federal money is that we learned after the fact that you can't use it to buy equipment. Well, what does a disadvantaged farmer need more than anything else? It's equipment. So we've already gone back to the federal government and say, hey, if you are really serious about a program like this, you have to think about some capital investments to help these farmers grow.
All of those kind of equipment investments are huge. And then the last thing I'll say is, cold storage is a thing that we see really, really frequently on farms, especially farms that are further away from markets like New Orleans, where they might need to harvest two or three times and keep something in a cooler before they can make delivery to the city, what with gas prices or even with poor transportation. So coolers are a big piece of infrastructure that we see people need access to.
And you're creating hubs with some of these things, right?
That's correct, yeah, allowing people to aggregate.
And sometimes the food bank can help be a hub because, again, cold storage is something that we have. It's something we can do and something that we can offer. So thinking about that going forward, because that would cost a farmer here and make it impossible for them to get a good enough price, be paid enough for their labor to actually be sustainable. Well, if we can fill that middle piece where we're helping them with the storage or the value-added processing, et cetera, or the transportation of food, now you have a farmer that's able to make a good living, and people who can't normally afford really good fresh produce have access to this for the first time. And I love that, because that's really fixing a food system problem and challenge that we have.
How about that bag of groceries that might go home with a child who is perhaps not getting the nutrition? Explain that, how that works, and that issue that you all deal with.
You know, everything that Second Harvest does is through partners. We really hold that value very, very closely. It's collaborative. Whether it's a community-based organization or a church or a nonprofit or a hospital or a school. So we work with more than a dozen schools right now. We have school pantries where the principals and the nurses that identify children that are exhibiting the signs of not having enough nutritious food can send a bag of staples home with that child to their families, and they can see the immediate results in their ability to learn. Or the cancer clinic, UMC, and now Ochsner, where we actually give cancer patients who are going in for treatments a box of appropriate produce for them to take home. And it not only helps them improve their diet, but also alleviates the stress. So these are the kinds of partnerships Second Harvest loves to be involved in, because it multiplies the impact of bringing food to the table. It brings food in the most helpful, nourishing way possible. That's why I like Nourish Louisiana as this program.
It's a great name. It's a great program. And so thrilling to be able to talk with you all about it.
Thank you for lifting it up, Poppy.
Thank you.
That was Margie Green, Executive Director of Sprout NOLA, and Natalie J. Rowe, President and CEO of Second Harvest. They joined us to talk about the food purchase program, Nourish Louisiana. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. Major support for Louisiana Eats comes from Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo, that's the good stuff. And the Audubon Clubhouse from Dickie Brennan and Company. Situated in Audubon Park, just off Magazine Street, the newly renovated and expanded property adds a bar and private dining space to the expansive wraparound porch and dining room. Serving lunch Monday through Friday, weekend brunch, and now dinner Monday through Thursday till 9 p.m. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans. Camellia's new red beans for two and white beans for two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans, scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. all handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit d'agostinopasta.com to learn more. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.